Thank you very much for being part of it. It's really quite frightening to recognize that it probably was before at least some of you were born. I think it was, 20 years ago that I was Orthodox advisor here. So I will do the advertising first. Should we circulate it now? There is a sign. Oops, I don't
need to knock the competition, literally.
So there is a sign-up sheet here. If you're interested in receiving the weekly emails, if you decide after the show you didn't like it, you can cross your name off afterwards. Or, of course, you can unsubscribe. But if you're interested in receiving both the weekly Dvar Torah and or the announcements of the various programs we run, this is a great way to be in touch. The core program that probably some of you are familiar with is called the Summer Beit Midrash, which is a six-week full-time co-ed seminar. Advanced Shemesh and Halakha, where you do a single halachic topic intensely for 4 weeks, 4.5 weeks, write a tshuva for a week, and then critique each other's tshuvas for several days. I think it's really the only kind of program like it in the world, and I tend to think the highest level Talmud Torah available to women anywhere in the world, any kind of program. So strongly encourage you to consider it. I'm happy to take more information to stay in shmooze with you afterwards. Okay, so tonight we're going to do a couple of things that I don't usually do. It's a little dangerous. I hope that you'll share and date myself. It's a Beatles song, you know, that if I sing out of key, I hope you won't stand up and walk out on me. But if I get stuck and it stops making sense, I'll get by with a little help from my friends. So the two things that I'm doing that I don't usually do, one is I'm going to be a little bit more personal than I usually am, and two, there always has to be a time when you give a shiur the first time, so this is a shiur I'm giving for the very first time, and so it'll be raw, and it's not going to be complete, but we'll tape this one, and then I'll give it again in a few months, and you'll hear it's much better because of you. I hope it's much better because of you. It comes about, often when you get overscheduled. So the thing I usually do when I get overscheduled is to schedule myself to give a totally new shiur so that I'll have an excuse for avoiding everything I have to do and learn. So here's what I want to talk about. Right? The question I want to talk about is the extent to which halakha is, if we put a slanted framework, halakha is a straitjacket. And it'll fit you better or worse as you change in life, but halakha is exactly the same thing, right? So you're working around in a halakha doesn't move with you. It's exactly the same, and all you can do is try and adapt around it. If you want a slightly less invidious thing, halakha, you walk around life in sort of this cardboard box, which has sort of space for you to move around it, but the box itself doesn't anyway adapt to who you are. That's one vision, right? The halakha is absolutely unaffected by who you are, and therefore there's no way in which halakha could possibly be affected by changes in who you are. Another vision, which might seem a radically different vision, I don't know which one of these is more obvious to you, says that halakha is, to some extent, adaptive to who you are. And that as you change, halakha changes with you. And not, I want to be clear, I don't want to claim that halakha, that your perception of halakha changes. And so you used to think that it was okay to do this, but now you think it's not. Or you used to think it's not okay to do this, but you've discovered all along you think you have the one truth, and your perception of the truth changes. I want to make the suggestion that living within halakha, it might be that as you change, actually the halakha is different depending on who you are. Okay, that's the idea I want to set. Is there any validity to that? So now we'll go back to the little bit of autobiographical thing. So probably I should stop every year making some kind of generational age comment. I'm still processing, A, my daughter getting married, and B, this past... thank you. And B, this past summer where, for the first time, somebody with smicha looked at me, actually a relative of mine, and we're sitting on my porch, and he said, yes, but that was your generation. So I'm still getting used to this. But this is about 30 years ago, when I was 18, I had one of... 17 or 18, probably. I had one of those... experiences where you hear a shiur that I think at the time already knew probably would change my life to some extent and really haven't changed my perception of that. You can tell how radically it affected me and that I am probably obsessively attached to originality. I never like writing other people's stuff. And this was a shiur that when I heard it, I just went out and I summarized it and published a summary without any attempt at creativity, which was deeply ironic because it was, of course, a shiur about the importance of creativity. Right, so I wanted to, it was a shiur by Rabbi Michael Rosenzweig, who was Rosh Hashiva at YU, was then a lot younger than I am now. And it was his first big public. It was his first big public shiur. He was, I think, 27. And I had never heard anything like it. I was just totally blown away. Afterwards, he published it. You can hear both. You can both read and hear it on YU. Read it, and I encourage you strongly to hear it rather than read it, because the oral version is cooler than the written version. And you can try and guess which question it is that I ask in the background towards the end. So I want, this was a shiur which just totally changed my attitude, I think. It said so many things I had wanted to be true and hadn't heard before, or put together things that I'd never thought about before. So I'm going to take very selected excerpts from this. So that's the first page. The English page is excerpts from the article. And I want to take you through it. And I'll talk about the ways in which the excerpts are slanted, so that if you read the whole article, you'll see that I'm not presenting it exactly as is. And then I want to take the ideas in that article, and I want to play them out into the specific question of whether halakha changes with you. But I want to be clear, Rabbi Rosenzweig was not in the slightest interested in that. And as we go through the shiur, I'll point out where he, in some ways, tried to prevent that implication. And nonetheless, I think it's still valid. So here we go. So he begins by saying that Rav Soloveitchik, by which he means Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, the Rav Zichrono Livracha, has suggested that imitatio Dei, the idea that one has to imitate, one has to be like God, I say the Rambam's phrase is lidamot lo kemasha efshar, to be as similar to God as possible, is not restricted to specific activities or midot or characteristics which govern interpersonal relationships, such as mahu chanun v'rachum afata hu heye chanun v'rachum. So the Gemara says in various places that you should be like God. What does that mean? Just like God is kind, you should be kind. Just like God visits the sick, you should be sick. And that's basically the framework in which God says it. Now, there are all sorts of theological problems with it, right? Because God doesn't just visit the sick, he makes people sick. So we could make a theological argument that just like God makes people sick and then visits them, so you should poison people and then visit them. We have all sorts of, right? God buries the dead, God also kills people, right? So we can have all sorts of interesting theological notions as to how you can figure out that what ways you're supposed to be like God and what ways you're not supposed to be. But let's assume that we've solved that problem. Right? We know which ways you're supposed to be like God and which ways not. You're supposed to be like the aspects of God which we think are nice and not like the aspects of God which we think give rise to deep theological crises. Soloveitchik said that there's actually a whole nother idea that doesn't show up anywhere explicitly in the Gemara, but is implicit, and really is that there's another characteristic of God that is fundamental religiously. Is really, what does it mean to be like God? It means to fulfill your own Tzelem Elokim. And what does it mean to be Tzelem Elokim? So what's the first thing God does in Chumash? How does God introduce himself to us? As the Creator. So Rav Soloveitchik said, Mahu Borei, Afata Borei. That, right, not only should you be kind like God, you have to be creative. In the same way that God is. Now that's an interesting idea. To be creative, just right, to be creative is a religious good, and it's the way in which you're like God. So Rosenzweig then backed away, and looked at the second paragraph, and he says that the Rav at that point had just published a book called Halachic Mind. For those of you who don't know, Halachic Mind was a book the Rav had actually written. It's really the first book he wrote. It was written in the 1930s, but it wasn't published until the late 80s. It's actually the precursor to Halachic Man, but it wasn't published until much later. So at that point, it had just come out, and Rosenzweig said, if you look at that, right, it's the halachic mind is really an attack on what he calls religious subjectivism, which is the idea that who you are has any effect on halacha. So he set up this tension, which he argued was within the Rav. On the one hand, you have a religious obligation to be creative, and on the other hand, you have this notion that the whole purpose of halacha is to prevent subjectivity and individuality. On the other hand, what sense would it make to say that human beings are supposed to be creative except in Torah, what human beings are supposed to do is learn Torah, especially Jewish human beings. So the whole article is an attempt to try and say there has to be some way in which you can reconcile the notion that halakha is supposed to be objective and not affected by individuality with this imperative to be creative. And so he sets out a whole series of, it was just a grand collection of sources that he argued militated in favor of some kind of religious subjectivity. So at the end of the day, you have to say religious subjectivity is not, halachic subjectivity, in some sense is not a problem. And we have to figure out, if you're a student or a salvation, how you can square that with the overall thesis that the purpose of halakha is to be objective. So among those sources were just the notion, now this is, I don't know how many of you self-identify as briskers, I don't think that's so popular anymore. It used to be like that was one of the fundamental categories of human beings. Briskers believed, right, that obviously all human beings can be divided into two fundamental categories, those who are briskers. And those who aren't. So the kind of argument that really appeals to a brisker, Rosenzweig said something like, "Well, you know what? There is this mitzvah called hidur mitzvah. Right? You have to make mitzvot beautiful. Now, how does that affect halacha? So let's say I have the four species. Right? I have my lulav. Forget the esrog for now. It's a bit of a problem. I have my lulav, my hadas, my aravas, and I want to hold them in my hand." And so I figure, you know what, it's kind of awkward to hold hold this kind of spiky stuff on my hands. You know, so I have this cool idea. I am going to put them into some kind of holder. Okay? Now that won't work. You can't hold the lulav, the arava, and the hadas in a holder because that's a chatzitza. Right? Your hand is not holding the chetza, the object of the mitzvah. And so, right, and so it shouldn't work. But if the holder is attractive, right, I'm doing it because I wish to make the mitzvah more beautiful. So there is one understanding which says that the things which I add to the, if this holder, I'm doing because I find it improves the aesthetics of the mitzvah. So it becomes part of the object of the mitzvah. So this for a brisker is absolutely demonstrable proof that there is subjectivity in halakha, because look, before you thought this was attractive, this wasn't part of the mitzvah. It was just this ugly, right, this ugly container. Now all of a sudden you think it's attractive and you've made it part of the mitzvah, and now you can hold it this way. Okay. So for those of you in that category, you're now totally convinced. Yes.
Couldn't you say that like there was like an if statement kind of embedded in the halakha all along?
Yeah, that.
And that if the if statement was always there, then the halakha had changed.
Yeah, so you can try and find on a much higher conceptual level, right, that there's an abstract halakha that's exactly the same, but experientially, right, two different people, one of them finds this attractive, one of them finds it ugly. The halakha is different.
I mean, the halakha is that if you find it attractive, do this, and
yeah,
you don't,
right, so that's always good, right, so that's how we'll balance it by saying it's not real, right, it's a way of introducing a subjective flux into the objective, right, into the objective matrix of the halakha or something, right? Because really the halakha is abstractly is fixed, but nonetheless, two people can ask me the same she'ela, and I can honestly give them different answers. So that, again, if you're a brisker, that makes all the difference in the world. If you're not a brisker, you say, what? Right, something like that. So he had another proof which I thought was actually much cooler, which was he claimed that the Rambam understands the last Mishnah Masechet Makot, which you all know, at least from the end of... Before people say Kaddish to Rabbanan, after learning in Shul on various occasions, they say, Amar Rechina ben Akashia, Ratzah HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Zakot Yisrael, God wanted to give the Jews merit, L'fichach, Hirba Lehem Torah U'Mitzvot. Therefore, he gave them lots of Torah and Mitzvot. So, really, like, maybe if God really wanted to give us lots of merit, he would have given us one mitzvah that was easy, and we could have just focused on that. Shatnez. Right? Imagine, right, if you have God said, you know what I want is all the Jews to go to Olam Haba. So I'll tell them, right, the way, right, so I'll tell them, I ask one thing of you, don't wear woolen linen woven together. So we'd all have, like, all sorts of things. Forget Schottness Laboratory, right? We'd have super shot. Everyone would wander around with electron microscopes so they could examine, right, so they could examine all their clothing, not just their wool clothing, because who knows, right, you know, even if a polyester suit, it might have Schottness in the collars. Every button on every object, we could all focus and we could do it right. Unfortunately now, it's probable that some of you unfortunately are going to Gehenna because you have missed the linen thread in your right in your wool. I don't really mean that. But don't be terrified, but it's possible, right? But actually, right, because we have lots of other mitzvahs, we have all this annoying meat and milk stuff, not to mention, you know, interpersonal kindness and davening and things like that. All those distract us from shatnez. Right? But if only God had just given us one mitzvah to focus on, shatnez, right, or, you know, something like, you know, less technical, I don't know, like, you know, tikkun olam or whatever, sorry, things like that, right? Right? Whatever mitzvah you want, we could have just had this one mitzvah and everything would have been great. So what does it mean? Therefore, he gave them lots of mitzvot. Lots of mitzvot are just like saying, well, I could give you the one question test, right? It's pass-fail. But I give you the 50 question test, they're each worth 2 points. The average of the class remains the same. It just changes the distribution. It's, you know, it's more a matter of luck if it's only one question. The average is going to remain the same. So what does it mean? So Rav Rosenzweig claimed that the Rambam said, and I'm not going to debate now whether he did or didn't. That's a great research project for you to figure out whether he did or didn't. I am never sure. They claimed that what the Rambam meant when he explained this was that that God gave us lots of mitzvot because each person can find a different mitzvah that resonates with them, and that right and. The Torah has so many things because everyone's supposed to specialize differently. It gives the opportunity for excelling in a particular thing. That's a really interesting idea, which maybe the Rambam said. Now the question is, as here I'm going to go beyond Rav Rosenzweig's brief, is that an argument as follows that. And he talks about this later on. So the problem of religious discourse that celebrates creativity in Torah is the same as any intellectually elitist discourse, which is that if you're not a creative intellectual, so we don't really have a purpose to exist. Right? That's really the fundamental problem. And this, you know, this has resonances in Jewish history. One of my favorite sources when I was young and arrogant was the Rambam in the introduction to the Parash Mishnayos, where he explains why inanimate objects exist, he explains why spiders exist. He has trouble explaining why non-philosophers exist. He finally decides that non-philosophers exist because philosophy is enhanced by the experience of wearing cool silk clothing. But cool silk clothing is only available in India. In order to get silk clothing in Europe, somebody has to travel across the sea to India. Only an idiot would actually take an ocean voyage and risk their life in order to get silk clothing. So that's why we have non-philosophers to go to India to bring silk clothing for philosophers. I think that kind of, you know, that issue has a certain amount of lack of resonance in many societies, particularly, you know, among people who don't perceive themselves as being part of that elite or who plan to grow up and be silk merchants. So I want to suggest the following, that really what underlies this idea is the notion that there are two ways to interpret Torah, to interpret halacha. One is by thinking about it and writing abstractions about it, and the other is by living it. Because most of the way in which you individuate a halachic life is by making choices, and those are the kind of choices that you will recognize from other things in Gemara. Like, what happens if I have to choose between spending my time on shatnez and spending my time on tikkun olam? What happens if I have to choose between spending my time, focusing my patience and my energy on kibud av v'eim or on davening? Those are real choices on hachnasas orchim. Right? These are all choices that you make, and you make in different ways. And so what I want to argue is that every halakhic life is implicitly an interpretation of Torah, and every individual is unique, so every individual lives a unique interpretation of Torah. And that's the solution to the elitism, that living a serious halakhic life always involves making choices, figuring out which mitzvot are the ones that resonate with your soul and that God put there so that you, right, could increase merit. And it doesn't mean that you get to do that to the exclusion of all others, but it means you get to focus on that. And that's in the same way when the Gemara talks about, you know, what happens if you have to choose between mitzvah X and mitzvah Y, Talmud Torah and Maaseh, right? All those things. So those are, your life could be written up as a Gemara. Kibudavim of Ikr Cholim, right? Miyadif. Which one takes precedence? So that's an important framework. That source, assuming that it's correctly interpreted, even if it wasn't, that the Rav Rosenzweig's interpretation of that had a deep effect on me. And then you pull out a whole bunch of other makaros that are familiar to you that talk about the uniqueness of each human being and the way and that God creates each individual human being because each individual human being has a purpose, each individual human being has an interpretation of Torah that is unique to their soul. And then Rav Rosenzweig talks about two possible implications. One is, he talks about how this idea really runs in the face of the whole notion of having codes of law. Because the whole point of a code of law is that everyone looks it up and gets the same answer. So one of his favorite sources is from the person who goes down as the brother of the Maharal. He had a first name also. But he goes down as the brother of the Maharal. So we tend to think of the Shulchan Aruch as this obvious consensus book. But when the Shulchan Aruch first came out, it was controversial. And it wasn't controversial just because the author was a controversial figure. It was controversial because the whole idea of there being an easily accessible book that people could look at and might think, and not necessarily wrongly, they could make decisions without actually looking at the sources, was controversial. And part of the controversy that Maharal's brother said very clearly is, this will end up with a halakha that is unrelated to the person. Right? It just exists in the abstract. This is what we call in the contemporary world the art scroll debate. Right? I should reiterate that the Shulchan Aruch was the art scroll of its day. And that's and I think that one should recognize that. One shouldn't, that's really a constant debate to what extent we want to make halakha available in this one size fits all. It doesn't take effort, it doesn't take subjective input role. And the other thing Rosenzweig talks about is to what extent does this have input not just in these sort of easy ways where there isn't really any halachic decision being made, although there are things that could be halachic decisions. We could choose to make the issue of kibud av v'aim and shatnez a halachic decision, but we've chosen thus far, until somebody writes the book that explains all the detailed choices you have to make, but we've chosen so far to largely leave it to you to decide in your life whether you want to prioritize shatnez or kibud av v'aim. But maybe it also affects poskim, and maybe when you're in a position of actually making law, you should, right? It's legitimate to say, who I am is going to determine what the law is for lots of people, because I'm supposed to have some input in that. And then we talk about who you are as a community, all those ways that the halakha actually is affected by who you are. I should say, by the way, for those of you who don't know, I'm using shatnez to some extent as a comic foil, but it's also a really important historical story. For those of you who don't know, the Shatnez Laboratory was founded by one man who decided that it was his purpose in life to recreate the mitzvah of shatnez shatnez checking in North America. And he dedicated his life to it, and he had an astounding success. Even though you could argue halachically that most of it was unnecessary. But he decided this was his focus. We weren't going to rely on the overwhelming majority of suits not containing shatnez, and certainly not shatnez d'oraita. We were going to gashtron, we were going to know what each suit was. And he put out these amazing calendars, which had these little vignettes of people who bought a suit, and the owner of the store assured them that it didn't have any shatnez in it because he knew. And then they die, and they go and they come to Shemayim, and they get sent to hell. And that's why. He says, because you relied on the order. Who told you that? Or Caesar's walking down the street, and all of a sudden, zap, lightning bolt comes. And it's amazing. It's an absolutely amazing, sort of crudely drawn, but early social media, where we put the little ads in newspapers and things like that. And so that just created this amazing public awareness. And then built this incredibly, this incredible structure where he trained other shatnez checkers, but the rule was anybody he trained had to send a sample of every garment they tested to him with a whole array of other data, and he built a database so that you right, so that he knew which things had to be checked, which brands had shatnas in them and which brands didn't have shatnas in them, and where they were manufactured and which plant. So I know many years ago I tried to rent a tux, and I called the shatnas laboratory, you know, and they said, okay, what's the brand? What's the lot number? you know, right? And they had a little, nope, we've tested 16 of those and none of them have had shatnas in them, so you're fine renting that tux. An amazing thing. We could talk about whether it's necessary, but that was his mitzvah, and he got it, and that was presumably, you know, if you ever wonder, like people talk about why is there a mitzvah of shatnas in the Torah, it was for him, because that was a mitzvah that resonated with his soul. Don't assume that the things that resonate with you are the things that resonate with everyone else. It might very well be that there are mitzvot that you've always thought were the wildest, obscure things that have no purpose at all, and obviously are just there because God wants to train you into obedience. But somebody else, that's what lights their spark. And if that were not in Torah, what would he have done? Okay, so that's our basic framework. So now I want to go. Now we can turn the page to the Hebrew sources. But if you have trouble reading the Hebrew Aramaic, nothing I say is going to depend on the specific reading of the sources. So you can follow along with me as I tell you what I think they say, and then afterwards you can go look up the translations and see if I made it all up. And then go if I did, then you should go find other sources that prove I'm right. Because obviously the point is to agree with me, not to or not. That's fine. You can exercise your creativity as you wish. So I'm starting off with this framework that I got when I was 18 from Rosenzweig, and that I have stayed in dialogue with ever since. That creativity, and that's an amazing thing that Rav contributed, and Rosenzweig just highlighted it, that creativity is a religious value, and that this extends to the notion of how you learn how you live your life. And that you're supposed to be a creative religious figure in everything you do. So how does that relate to the question of halakha changing as you change? So the first question you have to ask is halakha law? Because law doesn't, right? This whole notion, right, it's all very nice in theory, and Rosenzweig really talks about learning Torah. When you learn Torah, that's not law. But if we talk about law, right, so like, if we don't usually say like the law is that, I usually say at least, the law is that people with good reflexes should drive 90 and people 90 miles an hour, and people with bad reflexes should drive 50. Right? That's not usually the way we frame. Not usually the way we frame the law. The whole point of the law is that it's supposed to be objective, and right, and that we, right, and that we don't want to introduce that kind of discretion in which we say, no, that's okay for you, but not for me. Right? That's antithetical to the whole notion of law. So the question is, does halakha function that way? Is halakha that kind of thing where we say that the law is the law, it doesn't matter who you are? Or are there places where we can argue it's explicit in halakha that what the law is depends on who you are? And if that's the case, halakha isn't really law the way we think of it in other contexts. Right, so that's the first thing I want to argue, is that if we can find a way in which halakha explicitly says that what the law is depends on who you are, and not only that, maybe what the law is depends on who you are, and you get to decide who you are. That would mean that at least parts of halakha aren't really law in the way we think of it. We have to change our whole focus. So I want to argue there are two places where it might be that this is the case. So the first is the Avudraham in when he's talking about the bracha of Shechayanu. So probably all of you know, it's like ongoing tension. Like what do you make a Shechayanu on? Do you make a Shechayanu every time you buy a pair of socks and wear them for the first time? Right? What's our threshold? Do you have to buy a new car? What happens if, right, different people, what happens if you find, you know, there's a question of worth, what happens if you, like, I've been looking for the perfect pair of cufflinks for 6 years to match my suit, and today I find them and they cost $2. But they match perfectly. So do I make a Shechayanu? And those are, right, those, right, that's a, you know, or does it have to be, you know, does it have to be something that that another person would look at me? So that's also different between Ashkenazim and Sephardim. Sephardim tend to be what Ashkenazim would consider bracha happy. Right, Ashkenazim tend to be somewhat religiously constricted in the matter of brachot. But here's the early medieval discussion. So the Avudraham says that if you build a new house or buy a new house or you plant a vineyard or a field this is the problem, right? Kelim chadashim, you buy new stuff. What kind of new stuff? Doesn't tell you. Even if you have other stuff like it already, you make a shechiyanu, right? Because you're thanking God who gave us life and sustained us to benefit, right, to acquire this. But now the Tosfot writes that you should only make a bracha on things that are important. Not every time you buy something. Because, right, you know, if, as Americans, right, imagine if we made a shechiyanu every time we bought something. Right, you know, the ratio of shechiyanu to asher yasser would be 25 to 1 or something. You're buying stuff all the time. Right, you know, there'd be no time to do anything, but no time to keep it up. Pardon?
Do you buy stuff all the time?
I buy lots of stuff. We all buy, like, you know, you probably have automatic stuff and Amazon shipping things too, right? My wife, we have setups, right? That there's all sorts of things that get shipped regularly from Amazon. Okay, so not food, right? We'll leave out, but tissues. Tissues are Caleb.
I don't know how often you buy tissues, but like.
Okay, maybe, right? Maybe you're less consumerist than I am. That's fine. Good for you. More time to focus on kibbutz avim. But it's a lot. And Tosfos said, no, that doesn't work. It has to be something important. Analogous, it has to be like building. Tosfos says, like, radical. It has to be like building a new house. That's a very high threshold, right? They only make a shechna on things that are as important as building a new house. Okay, then Tosfos writes, so the things that aren't so important, Tosfos says, like a jacket or shoes, things like that, no, don't make shechinim. Okay, now here's the line. The cuss of Harush, this is the last line of the first source. The Rush wrote, Yesh Lomar, we can say, Hakol Lefi Shehu Adam. Everything is the right according to who you are as a human being. Because, Sheyesh Ani Shesameach Bechaluk, because there are poor people who celebrate a smock more than rich people celebrate Armani suits. So there's an important move. You ask the question, should I make a shechinu? The answer is, it depends on how you feel about it. If this is something that you feel is important, make a shechinu. Nobody can test, that's untestable. Nobody, right? You can't tell you a court and say, look, that person didn't make a shechianu, even though they should have, or that person made a bracha levatol. How do you know? I thought, right, you look at it and you say, cheap pair of cufflinks. I say, but they match my suits. Sorry, I only wear cufflinks on Shabbos usually. Happens I've just found the perfect pair of cufflinks this week, so it's on my mind. Yes?
Wouldn't, like, some, like, heavenly court, sort of speak, be able to identify whether or not you had measured up to your personal standard then?
Which a heavenly court.
Objectively identifiable by such an arbiter?
I suppose it could be, but maybe they'll just judge you on integrity. Right? Did you think you were... Okay. Right, so that's one line. The same kind of notion shows up in an idea which is much more, probably has contemporary resonance in a different way, which is how you balance your notion of sexual exposure. How do you make decisions about whether you're putting yourself in situations where you are likely to sin, as opposed to, right, in situations where there's something lost. And there are all sorts of areas that comes up. The specific situation which Rav Wozner is talking about is whether a wife should go to mikveh in a situation where there are outside external reasons that she and her husband will be in the house but can't actually have intimate relations. But it shows up, a basic question, living in a co-ed society, going to a really valuable movie that nonetheless you know contains certain kinds of sexual content, making the decision to have an internet account. All those are regular life decisions about how, right, which all of us deal with, but how you balance how you make the determination as to what extent you're willing to live outside the walls of the Beit Midrash. And what things are worth it, what things aren't, right? And each of their dangers in the Beit Midrash as well, but each of us has to balance their own rights. So is there halakha? So there are people who, you know, who'd decide the same way that there are women's tzniut books that, you know, that come with objective measurements of hem length and things like that. So there are also books that talk about you can see this and not see that. You know, the halakha of we can have the rubric, can you go see a PG-13 movie? Okay, I said a halachi question. Can you go see a PG-13 movie? And then you have the radical different approach, which is, you know, Shemuel Levy says here, which I think is the way that many modern Orthodox poskim would tend to say, which is to say, Hakol lefi shehu adam. Right? People have to be honest with themselves, very hard. Honest with themselves about what the right about what the risks and dangers are. And ultimately, that's not something, even though there we could say, look, there is all sorts of important isurim that are involved, but we don't make a legal decision in the sense that somebody else imposes on you what it's supposed to be, but rather we say that this is something that you have to decide for yourself, what the halakha is for you, and then you can decide for yourself. You might decide that you don't trust yourself and ask somebody else. That's a different issue. But fundamentally, the halakha is what you think it is, if you're honest. So I want to say those two, right, those two forces create this framework for legitimating the notion that subjectivity, not just creativity that has to come with something new, but that every time you're constantly making, that your life is a new thing, and halakha fits who you are. So then the question is, then we move to the issue of change. Right, what happens if you change who you are? So some things, you will change automatically. Right? Some things, let's say I'm on that issue, so that things just change biologically. And right, depending on who you are, right, as you change biologically, so the things you can expose yourself to will change, will change or not as you get more or less money. So things, right, if you were poor and now you're rich, so things that made you really happy when you were poor, unless you're really, really good, if you're an amazingly deep character, so you might be that the same things make you happy as they used to, and more blessings to you. But probably, at some point, if you have a lot more money, the things that made you ecstatic when you were poor will no longer make you quite as happy. Although you should try to balance that, and vice versa. If you were rich, hopefully, now that you're poor, so that you'll be happy with things that didn't make you happy before. So there are ways in which, I think, in those frameworks, halakha changes with you. But I want to make a perhaps deeper argument, which is, those are all external circumstances. The halakha reacts to, right, we usually, I am this, and now the halakha, I figure out what the halakha is for me. What about choices that you make, that you bring about for yourself? Like, can you choose to say, I was this kind of person, that is the, right, that was the halakha for this kind of person, I no longer wish to be the kind of person for which that is the halakha. I wish to be a different kind of person, so that the halakha for me will be different. Right? To what extent is halakha a function of identity, not just of external circumstances? And if it is a function of identity, is it an identity that can shift? So the base text for me here is a Gemara that usually is quoted for different purposes, but you'll see this is the source B, the first paragraph, Gemara on Psachim, Daphnin Aleph, and Aleph, which says that when Rabba Bar Barchana came to Babel, so he ate Daitara, which was a kind of fat that in Eretz Yisrael was thought to be forbidden, but in Babel was thought to be permitted. I think I have the directions right away. I get disoriented. So they say, how can that be? We have a famous Mishnah which says that if you go from a place which has a stringent custom to a place which has a lenient custom, you're stuck with the stringent custom. Right? You can't get rid of your stringent customs by changing location. So Gemara says, and the last answer is Rav Ashi says, no, that's only if you intend to go back to your original place, if you haven't changed your home. But if you change your home, then you change your halachic identity, and you don't have to worry that last week the halacha was you couldn't eat this because you were an Israeli, and now you're an Iraqi and you can eat it. So right, so that's settled halacha, right? That if you move from a place where the custom is this way to a place where the custom is that way, and you don't intend to go back, you are now bound by the customs of the place you moved to, and you don't, right, even if they're more lenient than the place you came from. So now the question is, what happens if you move for that purpose? I want to move from Eretz Yisrael to Babel because I have spent all my life hearing about the Daitara sandwiches in Babylonia, and I want to, right, you say, that's crazy, but you might say, you know what, I grew up with my parents telling me that Bazooka chewing gum is the best chewing gum in the world, but in America we don't eat gelatin, I have a pasuk in America that gelatin is not animal gelatin is not kosher. So let's say bazooka isn't animal gelatin in Israel anymore either. But there was a long period of time where there was all sorts of stuff that was treif in America and kosher in Israel because the Israeli rabbinate allowed gelatin and the American rabbinate did not. The American Orthodox rabbinate did not. So can I move to Israel because I want to eat, I want to finally taste decent chewing gum? Now, the answer is, yeah. As long as you really move to Israel, right? You can't cheat and say, ha, I'm making Aliyah today, and then tomorrow you, right, you go home and you've got, you know, even if you go through all the citizenship rigmarole, but we know it was just for the chewing gum. And then you leave, right, that's cheating. But you can choose to go on Aliyah. So now, that's easy, but the issue is geography the only case like this, or is geography just an example of the halakha that is imposed upon you because of an identity as a member of a community? Because there are other kinds of communities. There is, yes?
Murders, accidental murders.
So the community, I mean, yes, that's another example. You can't change that one. You're stuck. Right? So I don't, right? So, okay, good theoretical case. Right? What I'm trying, moving for is, sorry, intellectual community. Right? Can you say, you know what? When I was 17, I got into the orbit of a really powerful Rosh Hashiva with a really cool mind, and I became a brisker. And briskers have all, it's like this whole vision of halakha, which changes the whole nature of halakha. You know, you end up, you wait much longer till Shabbos ends, and you try and fulfill all positions, and you decide all halakhic issues on the basis of abstractions. And there's a certain halakha that emerges for briskers, and that's who I was when I was 17. And then when I was in my early 20s, all of a sudden, you know, I had this sudden experience that actually practical halakha mattered. And practical halakha was interesting, which came as a complete shock to me, that practical halakha was interesting. And so my whole vision of halakha shifted, like who my teachers were shifted. So can we just say, you know what, the halakha is different for me than it was. So the Gemara Erevin talks about how people can choose, but right at one point they could choose whether to be members of Beit Hillel or members of Beit Shammai. And what the halakha was depended on whether you identified as a member of Beit Hillel or a member of Beit Shammai. And what you were supposed to do, depending on which community you identified with. So now, you can say Beit Hillel or Beit Shammai, but what happens if I am choosing? So you know what? Yesterday I was going to be centrist Orthodox, but today I'm going to be a Belzer Hasid. So can I make that choice? And so yesterday I was bound by the customs of the centrist Orthodox community, and now all of a sudden I'm bound by the customs of Belzer Hasidut. Or vice versa. Right? Can I shift like that? And nowadays, where geography is relatively trivial, right? The communities that we tie ourselves to nowadays are intellectual, and to some extent sociological, and ideological. So, does halakha change? Right? We say it's not an argument. You know, like, well, it's not an argument. Well, I think that you're supposed to be this way. I think you're supposed to be Haredi this way. And I think you're supposed to be non-Orthodox that way. That really the halakha in lots of areas is different, depending on whether you identify as Haredi or non-Orthodox. And it's actually a valid choice to decide to be one or the other. And this, right, that's on a big macro community scale, but maybe it's true on a micro scale also, right? That the halakha is different for people who recognize the value of literature and people who don't. People who don't recognize value in literature, so what's the point of reading? If somebody asks me a shaila and say, you know what, I'm going to college, there's an intro English class, and the intro English class is going to read, I don't know, it's like Ayn Rand, or David Lawrence, or Lichtenstein's favorite examples, or Henry Miller, which Lichtenstein for some reason never even heard of, I guess, because he thought D.H. Lawrence was erotic. Although it's around the same period. So I might say, you know what, you know, somebody says, you know, why are you taking the class? Well, I need it for a Parnassa. Well, so take a different class. But it's an easier A, tough. Right? Take the harder class. Right, take the harder class and don't read stuff that you think will contaminate your soul.
Unless Talmud Torah.
Okay, less Talmud Torah, fine. It's an interesting argument. Nah, learn more. I, that's, you know,
if you get an A for Parnassa,
you'll get an A, yeah, okay.
Harder A, then you can spend less.
You might argue that. Wouldn't convince me at all. Okay. Wouldn't convince me at all. Right, like, I don't see exposing yourself to things that you think are totally valueless and, you know, and contaminate your soul because we get a little more Talmud Torah, bad trade-off. But I might say no, like, you know, my goal, you know, I find enormous meaning in certain kinds of literature. Let's say more contemporary thing I think would affect me more. Philip Roth. Right, so it might very well be that whether it's mutter or usher to read Philip Roth depends very much on who you are as a person. To what extent does it affect you? To what extent do you find meaning in it? Right, those are all, right, that's a really fun, yes?
Is that a little bit different from what you were talking about before? Because I feel like community membership and then just personal tendencies and likes and dislikes.
Absolutely. Right, so what I'm saying is I have two different kinds of sources. I have sources that say HaKol Lefi Shehu Adam, and I have sources that say you're allowed to change identity. And what I'm doing is trying to combine them and say that tells you that as you change. So one of the easiest markers for change is communal identity. But it should also be that who you are as a human being changes. And then the move I'm making, which I'm bringing for Rosenzweig, is to say, you know what, and that can be conscious. You can say, you know what, this is who I want to be. And even though yesterday I couldn't do this because I wasn't that kind of person, but now I identify as a different kind of person. Whether it happened naturally because I choose to be that way. And that really will yield a different halakha. Right, that's the argument I want to make, that there is a space for saying some things happen inevitably. So I'll give you, mashal I think about a lot, is R-rated movies. Why do R-rated movies interest me? Because they have an age limit. But to my knowledge, no one has ever explicitly said that the halakha should change at 17 as to what kind of movies you should watch. But there is an intuitive svar as to why we allow people to be exposed to different things at different ages. I know it's had a deep impression on me years ago. A public Jewish educator, prominent non-Orthodox Jewish educator, got up at a conference, and I later brought him in to a conference so he could say it again so I could argue with him. But I thought it was a really important argument. Where he got up and he said that one of the things he was really proud of is that in the school he was principal of, they banned Catcher in the Rye from the curriculum. So I have to say, I cannot stand Catcher in the Rye. Like, one of the, like, I don't identify with Holden Caulfield at all, but I just find, one of the kids I really didn't like and get along with in high school. But, right, despite that, right, so I have no briefs, I apologize, you know, those of you, I can get along with, I can appreciate people who read much more than I used to, but book doesn't do it for me. So I raised my hand, and I said, so he was very proud of that, and I raised my hand, and I said, have you read Catcher in the Rye? And he said, yes, of course, which is proper. That's the best reason to be a rabbi, is that you get to read everything decide if other people can. So then I said, do you regret having read it? And he said, no. So I said, then why are you not letting your kids read it? And he said, well, they're high school students. So I said, what? Are you making a halakhic argument? Since when are the things that are usher for high school students but mutter for adults? High school students are bar mitzvah. But maybe, right, so is there a notion? Right, is there a notion that that things should change with age? So I put in the last thing on the sheet. There's a really fascinating dispute. There's a single source put them together, but I couldn't come up with it in Bar-Ilan on short notice, which talks about the three books that Shlomo HaMelech wrote. So Shlomo HaMelech wrote Shir HaShirim, Mishlei, and Kohelet. And you have one position which says that Shlomo HaMelech had this one single revelation, and in this one single revelation, he wrote this, you know, he wrote this ecstatic, ecstatic erotic metaphor, and this, you know, this wholly unself-conscious, unironic wisdom literature, and then this like deeply cynical, you know, philosophic book, and he wrote them all at the same time. Which is a really cool idea that you can write all three of them at the same time. Really important, right? To know that yes, in fact, there are people who can simultaneously write totally different forms of literature at the same time, and it's, polemic aside, like the notion that you can engage in a discipline which says that the same person cannot have written these two things, because we know that authors can only write in one style. It's just the weirdest thing to me, the notion that this is a plausible intellectual endeavor. Down other things, but like the notion that you know what an author can do and what an author can't do is totally absurd. Then you have another vision, which says that Shlomo wrote Shir HaShirim in his youth, and Mishle in middle age, and Kohelet when he aged. So what is that telling you? It's telling you that people have different religious sensibilities. That's one of the normal processes is that you have a different religious sensibility as you age. And does it make sense that really halakha is a straitjacket? That halakha is exactly the same for people whose religious experience is Shir HaShirim and people whose religious experience is Kohelet? And that's a very odd thing. I would say, autobiographically, I should say that I mentioned some of you are our students, Rabbi Yitzhak Blau. That was sort of a very cool notion, I think people thought in high school when we were at one point, I won't go into details, but at one point there was a various of us took on Tanakh projects, and I took on Kohelet, he took on Shir HaShirim, and people thought that was very revealing of who we were as religious human beings of that type. So the notion that you write Kohelet and you write Kohelet when you're old and Shir HaShirim when you're young, yeah, maybe I'll yet write a Shir HaShirim. But I think that the idea, basically, that's telling you, right, that there are different notions as you age. Now, there might be the reverse of the notion that we have in America, which is that you are more, right, that we, you know, that we, to some extent, we allow more exposure to eroticism when you're older, and maybe halakha is reversed in certain ways. I do think, like the point I try to make in lots of settings, that we have a deep curricular problem or educational problem in our community that we, for a while, I think it's getting a lot better. We sort of train students to think that the apex of the religious life was when they were 19 and single. And then, you know, life comes along and distracts you from the pure Talmud Torah of yeshiva, and you'll never get back to the right to the real learning and religious experience you had in yeshiva. And, you know, at least in yeshiva, you're not really supposed to understand Shir HaShirim. Right? So Shir HaShirim is Kodesh Kodeshim, so we should at least train people to recognize that the goal of religious life should be to understand Shir HaShirim in some serious way, which hopefully you can't when you're a 19-year-old yeshiva student. But I want to set that. So I want to set that out. That the thesis I want to suggest is that we can think about halakha as much less a straitjacket than as when done a really well-tailored tessut. Or whatever article of clothing you happen to find, right? Most, you know, you're most likely to bring you to say Shechianu. And hopefully that shifts. Now, one of the last point I'll just put in for program propaganda is that recognizing that's what halacha is also changes your conception of what it means to be a posek. Because right, you can't have this vision that a posek is just engaging in a purely objective process if you think of halacha as something that is actually supposed to grow with people. So part of what the summer program does, and there are lots of other things that hopefully you can participate in, is to try and bring, you know, have all of you have that, you know, think about not just what it's like to be, not just to be consumers of halacha, but also producers. And producers doesn't, you know, at the highest level, producers means people who write really cool articles, but then recognize that this community produces a certain kind of social milieu where certain kind of things are permitted, and certain kind of things are forbidden. So every individual, every community is in a sense a producer of halakha. So a lot of what I try to do is to get people to be conscious of that experience and to do it as seriously as you can. But I think it's useful often to argue for the entire legitimacy of the project. To start with. Okay, so I will stop with that. People have questions. Pay to take a few questions publicly, and then we can release all of you to the intense academic work you probably have. And if you want to hang around, that's great, and hopefully lots of you signed up. If you haven't, you should sign up on your way out. Yes?
So this is like a clock. Like, where do we draw the line, though? Because like if this was the attitude towards halacha, which people had since Matan Torah, like, the halacha which we have right now would be radically different because we would be choosing, like, picking and choosing what we thought to put, like, should be emphasized. And then, like, I feel like the continuity, like, the Masorah of just, like, that idea of like halacha isn't like obviously this, like, it's a valid statement to say that, like, for some people something may be more meaningful. At the same time, like, halacha, like, you can't pick and choose. Like, halacha is halacha, and like with this like conception of halacha, like, how are we able to get to this point and still have these books with the same, you know, with the Masorah, which has come from Sinai.
Right, so that's a good question. The first thing you just do is validate the question. And the second thing to say is that I think I tried to demonstrate that the notion that halakha really is always just art scroll, and art scroll in the stereotype, not the real art scroll. Like, I know when I read, I read with my sister on a plane, I read through the art scroll Hilchot Avelut when we were on our way to Israel for Avelut, and we realized we couldn't, it was utterly unhelpful because it was basically all about the other 16 options. Right, choose one. Call your local Orthodox rabbi. So I think that if you study, you discover that this really is what halakha always has been, and the notion that there's lots of room for subjectivity doesn't mean that anything goes, and that's the boundary you have to try and find. So, right, where are those who are math people? So there are metaphors that are useful. Limits is a useful metaphor. Tending towards X, but you never actually get there. Right, all sorts of useful metaphors you can have. I think that it is, if you have a vision, and that's a particular, that the goal of halakha is to provide certainty, and to know it every single time that as long as if I follow the instructions, I will get into heaven. So this isn't a congenial approach. But if you think the goal of halakha is to develop your soul, then I think probably intuitively it resonates, and but then I think the question asks is exactly the right question. Usually in the Sanhedrin Midrash, there's a moment. I try and do it deliberately now because if I didn't get students to ask the question, then it would bad things happen afterwards because they thought of it afterwards. So if you actually teach people that poskim have discretion, so does that mean that poskim can do whatever they want? What if you teach that poskim have absolute discretion? Does that mean that really, let's suppose, if I teach you, right, there's this principle called Hefker Beit Din Hefker. Hefker Beit Din Hefker means that if any Beit Din can take away anyone's money in the world whenever they want. It's not cool, okay, which way? Let's just, that one position, probably the way we're talking is that's true. So let's suppose I convince you that is the halakha. But that can't be the halakha, right? So we have to figure out what are the, if even if that's theoretically a thing, what are the constraints that the system puts in place that will prevent that from ever happening. Right, so that's the same model, right? Once you recognize that, recognizing that the system itself is not wholly rigid, you then have to figure out, so what are the constraints on the system that prevent it from getting out of hand and from becoming just a free-for-all? And that's what I think the real work is figuring out how you find that boundary. And it's legit, and we should have big arguments about where the boundary is, which happily we do. And then everyone should agree with me. Which happily they don't yet. But you're all in the way. Yes.
So you're talking about community norms and the halakha with the net as kind of status quo. And I'm wondering if you see room for an individual trying to change community norms and status quo, or whether it's always the community changing the individual and then the individual conforming to the halakha of where they're living or their intellectual.
So I think that should say, first of all, those all the answer, at least approaches to all those questions are on TorahLeadership.org, which is the website of But there are two very simple answers. One is, nowhere in halakha does it ever say that you cannot argue that the halakha as it is wrong and should be different. Right? You're bound by halakha, just like you're bound by any other legal system in that sense, but you can think it's wrong. And you can advocate all you want for it to change, as long as you still are obedient. Right? So I might think that right now, I might think that all of Hilchot Kashrut, as we have it now in our community, is absurd, and we should go back. We should go to pure science, and pure science tells us that most of our metal alloys don't absorb, and therefore you should be able to use nonstick pots for Milchik and Fleishik interchangeably. Some people are arguing that now in the Sephardi community, but I just found it out recently. So I think that's not the halakha, but maybe I think it should be. So I can argue all I want. You can argue all you want, and eventually you might win. The second issue is much more complicated, for Americans we understand well, there might be a notion of civil disobedience. So I often say about that, and I gave a whole share about it in Columbia 2 years ago, I think it's on the websites. I think the challenge of civil disobedience is that civil disobedience assumes that you grant the authority structure the capacity to punish you. And that's very hard to construct in American Orthodoxy, where the community is voluntaristic. So there are no real sanctions for trying to change communal norms by appealing to people's conscience. So I think that's a deep. I think theoretically I have a lot of sympathy for it, but in practice it's very hard to justify. But argue, yeah, sure, try and change your community. Why not?
So instead, you should just move communities instead of trying to change the community.
No, I think you can. I think it's easy if you right. You know, if you say, but you know. I live in a community where people don't appreciate Graham Greene, therefore, you know, think the halakhah, you're not allowed to read Catholic writers. So I could stay in my community and say, you know what, no, right? I'm going to keep arguing that all of you need to read Graham Greene. None of you have ever heard of Graham Greene, probably. There was a time when people thought he would win the Nobel. In certain religious circles, he has some really cool stuff about religious leadership. So I might argue in the community I lived in, no, you should all read Graham Greene, and you should let me read Graham Greene too, or I might move. Right? That's, you know, when I was in high school, so my teachers, you know, strongly opposed my reading Mor Nebuchadnezzar. And they succeeded. I didn't read Mor Nebuchadnezzar in high school, which was a very good thing from my perspective, because it would have bored me out of my mind. So happily, it was saved, so I was the right age for it. But I went to YU, where many people thought you should read Mor Nebuchadnezzar. I could have stayed and said, I'm going to live my life in Breuers and fight for, right, and fight that everybody should read Mor Nebuchadnezzar. I didn't, you know, but I could have. There were other reasons that I wasn't really at home there. So I think that's a choice, you know, that's a choice you make. You might decide that, you know, so they're all, right, easy, you know, right, women's issues are an easy one, right? You might want to, you know, say, I'm going to stay in this community, I'm going to fight because I find the joy and beauty of community X so powerful that this is where I want to live, but I want to live in that community and have that community encourage women to learn Daf Yomi. Or you might say, you know what, I'll have to give up certain things and identify a different community where women do learn Daf Yomi. If you find it, tell me, please. Because that's the community I'm trying to build. And not Daf Yomi just as the first step. Right? So I think that's a fair choice. It's easy to make the choice to move communities, and I'm highly legitimating that. But it's not the only choice. You know, people make choices about communities and general things, and there's a price. Living in a community does bind you. I want to say that, right? Living in a community does bind you in certain ways. I don't think that we're all so atomistic now that there's no notion of communal norms in halakha now. Some of my friends and students disagree. I don't think that at all. But I think there are good reasons that people stay in a community and fight, as opposed to choose to just leave communities. Okay, it's the last question, I guess.
That's just more of a comment. You're talking about communal norms. I think it's kind of interesting because we're all kind of like planning to go home, kind of to a certain extent,
mm-hmm.
as college students here. And so, as far as like who practices we follow, that's kind of.
So that's a great, great
it's
question.
Kind of actually an interesting thing.
That's a great, great question, which is really deserves much, much more serious attention. Probably I should spend a summer on it at least, thinking about like what the. You know, the life cycle of the modern Orthodox species, where you grow up in Tinek, or you're born in Tinek, and then you live a year in Eretz Yisrael, and then you live 4 years in this campus environment, and then you live on the Upper West Side. Right. This is like easily if we tagged right the members of the modern Orthodox species, it'd be pretty clear, right, that there's a migratory pattern that is pretty evident. And we've been pretty successful though, right? You know, realize 30 years ago it was an endangered species, and now pretty much we're established that this is a pretty enduring species. But it's a really interesting challenge, right? Because none of you have a single communal identity. In that sense, right, for most right for your life, it was a big issue when I was in YU, and I entirely wrongly, I was nervous about the Israel phenomenon because I thought, the impact was everybody came to yeshiva and never formed a community. Your community was the yeshiva you came from in Israel. It was the good was so radically outweighed the bad that that my concern about that was just misplaced. But it's a really great question. It's a really great question. To what extent the campus community is the home for college students while you're here, and those are the norms that are established. On the other hand, a community, as some of my colleagues have pointed out, I think like the challenge of being a Rosh Yeshiva is that you never talk seriously to anybody over 20. Your whole worldview is shaped by what's good for 18 to 20-year-olds. All right, that's a very distorting vision. Right, that's a difference between shul rabbis and Rosh Yeshiva, really, in certain ways. I usually don't like the critique at all, and most Rosh Yeshiva are also shul rabbis. But it's really an interesting thing if your whole, right, if you're intellectual, if you're serious intellectual dialogue with 18 to 20-year-olds. So that's an whole issue, whether, to what extent a community that is so limited demographically, right, is really a community. I think that needs enormous work logically. One more question? Sure, that was a great question. There's another one. Thank you.
It's sort of related, I think, because that's relating to people that are somehow in transition, maybe. I'm wondering if the idea of like the Ein Tzav Zor applies to the categories of identity that are non-geographical. So in order for you to like change your halachic identity, does it need to be like a permanent decision? Does it need to be made with the intentionality of it being permanent?
That's a great question. That's a great, great question. Do we allow people to slum? I'm going to hang out in the mirror for 6 months, or in Migdal Oz, whatever it is. And right, do I have to keep all my chumras? The formal argument would be yes. But I haven't. That's a great question. Also, wow, good for you guys. At a formal level, the answer should be yes. But I don't want to assume that the formal argument is true. So I would say that would be my default setting. If you had forced me into it now, I would say, that you can't adopt the kulos of the community, right, just because when you explore it for 6 months.
Right. So I think that asked the answer more to answer Evan's question about like, does your little bit of new change if you know that certain things are going to be temporary?
Yes. And to what extent is college temporary? To what extent do people?
A lot of us still have our addresses listed as our home addresses.
Yes, that's an interesting question. Voting, right? But how many of you expect to go back to your?
For how long, though?
I think so. That's a fair question, also. Right? What happens if you think you'll go back to your and live in your parents' basements for 3 years until you finish like whatever grad school you're doing? But in the end, you're going to be free, right? You're going to move to Eretz Yisrael. You're going to, right. So when is it that you moved in your head?
Yeah, but like if you're living, that's like saying if you're living in Eretz Yisrael, you're thinking you might move to like Turkey in a few years, but like you haven't moved yet, and you're going to go somewhere else.
So that's a really interesting argument to claim that college students haven't moved anywhere at all yet. So college students should all be bound by their home communities, and there should be no local minhag at all.
I think that's
interesting. When I was at Harvard, I didn't, as a rabbi at Harvard, I didn't take that position. I tried very hard, but that's a narrow issue, let's say. For example, I tried very hard to establish that the minhag of Cambridge was you didn't get married without a prenup. Even though there were very, very few communities back then that, the prenup was pretty new. So we were like the first community. But I tried very hard, like, this community is a community. So I was very into establishing it as a community that had norms. It did have adults which had some kind of tradition.
But like, if you go to college and you go home, you don't say you're visiting home. Maybe you do, but like I wouldn't, for example. Right?
So I think that's a great question. That's a great, great question. That's a great, great question. Yeah, I think the totally secular analog is Rumspringa. As opposed to thinking of college as this complete, Hefker world, it's halachic Rumspringa, right? Where you get to try out all sorts of different halachic identities while you're here. That's a great question. Now, I need those of you know, Rumspringa is the period the Amish give their teens off before they decide to voluntarily recommit to the there's a documentary called The Devil's Playground that you can decide as an interesser to watch. which explores. And you also read the critiques of it, whether that's really what it's like for all of them. That's really like for all of them or not. Those are really good questions. I think that we have not really adapted to the notion that, right, that the that people's communities automatically shift geographically as they age, and figure like what is it for you go to Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael, right? It's an easy credit, right? So. Do we tell you that you're a Ben Eretz Yisrael so you can keep only one day if you hold that way? I think you keep one day anyway, right? But according to the people who hold that you're that Ben Chutz La'aretz and Eretz Yisrael has to keep 2 days, so at what point do you shift? So we say, well, if you're single, right? Rav Avadia says, if you're single, you're probably going to stay. You might get married, right? So when you go to yeshiva, you move. Right? So that, there are lots of ways. There are lots of ways to construct a, right, a notion of change, even though there you do intend to, you say you intend to go back, but we say, but you're here. You're in here for a year. What does that mean? You intend to go back eventually.
Do you already have commitments to attending Grad?
Ah, so we have a commitment. Yeah, but, you know, people have shifted before. Great, great questions. Okay, so that probably, people want to ask questions. First of all, if you haven't signed up, sign up. If you haven't yet thought about attending the Summer of Midrash and you have the skills to learn Gemara really well and Rosh Hashanah well, then you should, you know, start planning for July 3rd to August 11th this summer. And if you have other, you know, if there are other ways in which what I'm, you know, the kind of vision I'm presenting is attractive, so if you start by following the Torah, and we'll figure out the ways in which hopefully longer term experiences can be constructed. This is somebody else's recording, right? Yes. So whoever's doing this, I would appreciate if you would email me afterwards. And at this point, actually, you know, those of you who want to hang out and stay, hang out and stay. If you want to come up and introduce yourselves, please come up and introduce yourselves.
As far as we were talking about people changing identities and changing, like, I think the most obvious interesting example would seem to be Bar Mitzvah.
Yes, I didn't want to use that good excuse, but I like the different host things.
Thank you.